Hello, it's Thursday, March 23rd. I'm Bob McAllister, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Courant and the New York Times with me today is Lodi Avola. Excuse me. We're going to take a look at the photos on the front pages of today's newspapers, as we always do, and the Hartford Courant has got hundreds of people on the front page, and I'll try to explain the biggest picture, which is about 8 inches high and 4 columns wide, shows a raft, for lack of a better word, of college students at UConn in front of the Gamble Pavilion, where they are all saying goodbye to the UConn women's team, who are on their way to Seattle for the next round of the March Madness, and the Sweet 16, I should say. It, of course, shows them all happy, smiling, many of them on their telephones and taking pictures. They look like any group of teenagers, unkempt, sloppy, torn dungarees, hats over their heads. They all have a phone in their hand, and I can't describe it any better than that. In the center, however, is Amara DeBerry, one of UConn's lady players, with long braided, corn braid hair all the way down to her waist, hollering to the crowd. And back of her is Lou Lopez Senechel, and she is a highlight of the team, that's for sure. But they've been successful, and they're on their way to Seattle. Below that, another picture about 2 columns wide, 3 inches high, showing a smiling 6'5" Dorca Juhas, the center for the team, long flowing blonde hair, dressed with a black sweater, black slacks, again surrounded by hundreds of UConn students as she makes her way through this rally. I can see there are tubas in the background, so obviously the UConn band is there once again. The ubiquitous telephone in every student's hand, and again, hundreds of students in that picture. Below that, another picture about the same size showing Azy Fudd, another UConn star who has been on the sick injured list for a long time, but who contributed very much to the success of their last game against Baylor. She is, of course, in her black hoodie with a hood back, big smile on her face, rings on her fingers, and she's holding a phone as well. And she also surrounded by students who are taking pictures of something, I don't know what. But anyway, a happy time at UConn as they head for Seattle, and we wish them every success there. The only other picture on the front page shows a couple of buildings on Trinity Street, which used to be their historic buildings, but they may be converted to apartments. These were both former state offices in one of their iterations. So a little good news for downtown Hartford as well. Lodia?
Okay, and the New York Times front page. All my stories will be from the New York Times. The main picture, about a 5x7, is of a hot spring in Tanai, Japan. Apparently, the nation sits on top of a huge geothermal source, and the nation has 13,000 hot spring spas, and we're not doing that story, which is why I'm giving you a little more detail. But the picture is of a man in what must be one of these spas, surrounded by giant rocks. In the background, it looks like he's in the woods, but there's snow on the ground, and he is in this spa. You see him from chest high, bare-chested, just sitting there with his eyes closed, obviously relaxing. That's our top picture. And then a story will follow this picture, but it's a small, maybe a 3x4 picture. Tiny writing. It's of a document, so it's in sepia tones. It has some tiny writing. And then there's a tuft of hair taped to this piece of paper, and this piece of hair, this tuft of hair, is believed to have been from Beethoven, and they're using this and several other locks to determine his DNA sequence. And the final picture, about the same size, small, is a colored picture of the teachers' union strike in Los Angeles. Obviously, a rainy day. It shows people. There are a lot of people, but the two highlighted in the front, a young man holding a sign that says "Quality Schools, Better Lives," and then a woman behind him holding up what it is. It's a blurry sign, so I can't read it all, but it's they're protesting in Los Angeles. So our first story this morning: Fed raises rates and keeps an eye on bank turmoil. Federal Reserve officials raised interest rates by a quarter point on Wednesday as they tried to balance two conflicting problems: the risk that inflation could remain rapid and the threat that turmoil in the banking system could slow the economy drastically. The Fed on Wednesday pushed interest rates to a range of 4.75% to 5%, and officials forecast one more rate increase in 2023, though they hinted that even that is uncertain. In doing so, policymakers tried to signal that they remain focused on wrestling down price increases, but were also paying attention to financial threats. In assessing the need for further hikes, we'll be focused on incoming data and the evolving outlook, and in particular on our assessment of the actual and expected effects of credit tightening, Jerome H. Powell, the Fed chair, suggested at his post-meeting news conference. The Fed statement said that some additional rate moves, quote, may be warranted, and Mr. Powell emphasized that may was crucial. Officials do not know that yet. His comments underlined that the outlook for whether rates would rise further, and if so, by how much, had been made uncertain by turmoil in the banking industry that could make loans harder to come by, slowing the economy. Officials forecast that next year they would lower rates more slowly than they had anticipated, so that rates linger at 4.3% by the end of 2024, up from 4.1%. That suggested that the fight for stable inflation could be a longer and more gradual one than many had expected even a few months ago, though the outlook is complicated by the bank turmoil. The forecasts and Mr. Powell's remarks together underlined that his central bank is confronting a complicated moment and trying to buy itself the time to decide how to react. Bob?
All right, this front page story from The Current. We're being brought back to the Jennifer Doulos story out of the past. Trakonis' lawyer says documents are withheld, and he tells the court she's being wrongly denied secret divorce records. Michelle Trakonis' lawyer tried to persuade the state Supreme Court on Wednesday that he has been wrongly denied access to records of a divorce case in which a judge improperly barred the public from a potentially explosive hearing and sealed a transcript from public view. Trakonis attorney John L. Shanehorn has been trying for years to obtain the transcript of a May 2019 custody hearing in the divorce of Jennifer and Fotis Doulos, a bitter breakup that ended not long after in one of the country's most notorious slayings and suicides. Jennifer Doulos appeared and is believed by the police to have been killed by her husband just days after the hearing, which was to determine who had custody of the couple's children. Her body has not been found. Fotis Doulos later was arrested and charged with her murder, but died by suicide before he could be tried. Trakonis, Fotis Doulos' girlfriend while the divorce was pending, is accused of conspiring with him to commit murder and obstruction of justice for, among other things, accompanying Doulos while he stuffed bags of bloody evidence into storm drains and garbage cans in Hartford. Shanehorn said he wants access to the hearing transcript to determine whether it contains anything that could support Trakonas' claim of innocence. She has been free on a $2 million bond since her arrest in January of 2020. Shanehorn will not say whether there is anything in particular he hopes to find, and he told the Supreme Court on Wednesday he is not trying to unseal the divorce record as Trakonas' lawyer, but on his own as a member of the public who has been aggrieved by the judiciary's refusal to provide him with a court record that he said has been sealed by an illegal, unconstitutional secret and, as a result, invalid court order. It is not unusual for proceedings and records in divorce and custody cases to be kept secret in order to protect the privacy rights of litigants from disclosure of materials such as deeply personal medical and psychiatric reports. But the case before the court turns on questions about how records were sealed. Both Shanehorn and the state's attorney general's office, which is defending the judiciary's refusal to release the records, agree that the Superior Court judge who presided over the custody hearing wrongly barred the public from the courtroom and illegally sealed the transcript. In order to close a court to the public and seal the record, Connecticut law requires judges to follow a detailed procedure that includes giving the public 2 weeks to contest the order, steps that were intentionally ignored during the custody hearing. The disagreement is over how Shanehorn decided to pursue the records. He asked another judge to unseal the transcript to provide him with a copy of the grounds that had been sealed illegally in the first place. Lodia, back to you.
From cleaning Trump's messes to defying him. When Michael D. Cohen stood before a federal judge to ask for leniency, he attributed much of his behavior to the influence of one man, Donald J. Trump. Time and time again, Mr. Cohen told the judge at his sentencing in late 2018, I felt it was my duty to cover up his dirty deeds. Ever since, Mr. Cohen has made it his work to expose those deeds. He testified for roughly 7 hours at a congressional hearing in 2019, describing Mr. Trump as a liar and a cheater who made racist remarks. Mr. Cohen also met with the special counsel, Robert S. Mueller III's investigators, and federal prosecutors in New York. And he has the impetus for the New York Attorney General's investigation into Mr. Trump's business practices, laying the groundwork for a lawsuit that accused the former president of inflating his net worth by billions of dollars. Mr. Cohen's transformation from trusted fixer to chief antagonist, a 180-degree turn against a man he once vowed to take a bullet for, upending his life. He went to prison for 13 months and then faced home confinement for more than a year. He endured years of attacks from Mr. Trump's allies, ultimately emerging with a book deal, cable news appearances, and a podcast, Mea Culpa, the name of the podcast. Now Mr. Cohen is poised to seize his biggest moment yet, a day in court against Mr. Trump. Mr. Cohen is the key witness in the Manhattan District Attorney's investigation into a hush money payment to a porn star named Stormy Daniels. The payment, which Mr. Cohen said he made at Mr. Trump's direction during the final days of the 2016 presidential campaign, blocked Ms. Daniels from telling her story of an affair with Mr. Trump years earlier. Mr. Cohen had met with the prosecutors some 20 times and recently testified before a grand jury that could indict Mr. Trump as soon as this week, people with knowledge of the matter said. And he has provided documentation that bolsters his testimony, the people added. On Wednesday, the grand jury did not meet as expected, two people with knowledge of the matter said, meaning that any indictment of the former president would come Thursday at the earliest. The panel may hear from at least one more witness before being asked to vote. Because the proceedings are kept secret, the timing of any charges is unknown. Mr. Trump has denied having any sexual encounter with Ms. Daniels and accused the district attorney, Alvin L. Bragg, a Democrat, of carrying out a political witch hunt against him. Bob?
This front page story on the war in Ukraine, Russia unleashes drones and missiles as attacks are stepped up after diplomacy trips in Kyiv and Moscow. Russia stepped up its missile and drone attacks against Ukraine on Wednesday, killing students and other civilians in a violent follow-up to dueling high-level diplomatic missions aimed at bringing peace after 13 months of war. Russia is shelling the city with bestial savagery, President Volodymyr Zelensky wrote in a Telegram post accompanying video showing what he said was a Russian missile striking a nine-story apartment building on a busy road in the southeastern city of Zaporizhzhia. Residential areas where ordinary people and children live are being fired at. At least one person was killed in the attack shown in the Zaporizhzhia video, apparently recorded by closed-circuit TV cameras. Elsewhere, Moscow's forces launched exploding drones before dawn, killing seven people in or near a student dormitory near Kyiv. Ukrainian media showed several angles of the missile raining down on an apartment building across the street from a shopping mall in Zaporizhzhia, producing a huge plume of gray and black smoke with bits of concrete flying into the air as cars whizzed by. Videos showed the violent outcome of the attack, charred apartments, flames, and smoke billowing out of several floors of the buildings and piles of broken concrete and shards of glass on the ground. Two children were among the wounded, said Zaporizhzhia City Council Secretary Anatoly Kurtiev, adding that 25 people needed hospital treatment, with three in critical condition. Zaporizhzhia City is about 60 miles from the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, Europe's largest, which has previously come under threat during the war and has been shut down for months. The UN's International Atomic Energy Agency reported the plant had suffered another loss of a backup external power source. Its six reactors still need power to cool nuclear fuel and were relying on only a primary source Wednesday, the IAEA said. Russia has denied targeting residential areas, even though artillery and rocket strikes hit apartment buildings and civilian infrastructure on a daily basis. Russian officials have blamed Ukrainian air defenses for some of the deadliest strikes on apartments, saying the deployment of air defense system in residential areas puts civilians at risk. Russia sometimes also claims Ukraine is hiding military equipment and personnel in civilian buildings. Excuse me. Earlier Wednesday, a drone attack damaged a high school and two dormitories in the city of Rishchev, south of the Ukrainian capital, officials said. It wasn't clear how many people were in the dormitories at the time. Lodia?
She posted online of war in Ukraine. Then she faced prison. Sitting in a small courtroom flanked by her two lawyers last month, Olesya Krivtsova was facing a stiff penalty for her fondness for posting on social media. Barely 20, and until this year a university student in northern Russia, she was accused of, quote, justifying terrorism and, another quote, discrediting the Russian armed forces, and was facing up to a decade in prison. Her apparent crime, an Instagram post asking why Ukrainians had rejoiced when the main bridge to Russian-occupied Crimea was attacked in October. The post eventually landed Ms. Krivtsova on the Kremlin's official list of terrorists and extremists. She was placed under house arrest and forbidden from using the phone or the internet. Ms. Krivtsova did not wait for a courtroom verdict. Last week, she fled the country. I decided to leave because I was desperate, Ms. Krivtsova said by telephone on Friday from Vilnius, Lithuania. It is impossible to prove anything to the Russian court. As the Kremlin intensifies its crackdown on free speech, social media platforms have become a more frequent target for punishment. The government is increasingly penalizing people for posts it considers critical of the fighting in Ukraine, with fines, imprisonment, and in extreme cases, temporarily losing custody of their children. In the Ryazan region south of Moscow, for instance, investigators opened a criminal case against a man who posted a joke about the Russian retreat from Kherson in southern Ukraine. A student who ran an anti-war channel on the messaging app Telegram was denounced by the rector of his university for posts that criticized the Kremlin's invasion of Ukraine. And that ends our first segment of news. We'll go to Bob with today's weather forecast.
Yes, and here's the weather as seen by the New York Times weather report. The national forecast says as a storm moves to the northeast, showers and thunderstorms will shift from the Midwest to the Mid-Atlantic and New England regions today. Cooler air will slip south in the wake of the storm. Warmth will also be on hold from the southeast to the south-central states with vast areas of sunshine. On the western edge of the warmth, an approaching storm from the Rockies will begin to set off thunderstorms from central Texas to southern Missouri later in the day and at night. Some of the storms will be severe. An area of heavy rain and flooding is forecast to develop by Friday from Arkansas to southern Ohio. Farther west, areas of rain and mountain snow will extend from Washington and Oregon to parts of Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico. And I would just say here, I'm glad I don't have to explain the appearance of the weather map as printed. There is every symbol imaginable and every barometric pressure line that I've ever seen on the New York Times weather report. It looks like a doozy. But here's the outlook for the Northeast. A weak cold front crossing western portions of New York and Pennsylvania will cause mostly cloudy skies on Thursday, along with the chance for a few showers, especially during the afternoon and Thursday evening. It will be on the breezy side, with south winds at 10 to 15 miles per hour and peak gusts between 25 and 30. Temperatures will continue above normal, with highs ranging from the mid-50s to the lower 60s. High pressure over southeastern Canada will ridge into the region Friday, bringing a partly sunny sky. It will be cooler, with highs mainly in the lower 50s.